Good day.
Today is Thursday, 5th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched and heard this programme, or whichever part of this programme you want to watch or listen to, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, today we are in, I believe, the fifth day of the conflict between the United States and Israel on the one hand and Iran on the other. And I'm going to suggest that the calculus, the underlying calculus, continues to be unchanged. For the moment, there has been no decisive advantage won by either side against the other, which, given that we're looking at a test of endurance, a long-duration war, is arguably more in Iran's favour, except, of course, that 5 days in what is likely to turn out to be a long endurance test, well, it is impossible to reach any quick judgments or conclusions as to who will withstand the pressure longest, based purely on what has happened over the first 5 days. Now, having said that, I'm going to discuss the latest military and political developments. The United States and Israel continue their attacks on Tehran. From what I understand, the attacks are mostly concentrated on northern Tehran. I presume that this is where most of the government institutions and structures are based. But what I would say is that it does have an effect, a political effect as well, since northern Tehran also happens to be the middle class area of Tehran, or so I understand. And this is where the bulk of the government's opponents in Tehran are concentrated. So it must be unsettling, shall we put it like this, for them, or for any of them that were expecting a Western bombing campaign to be the first step in what they would call their liberation from the current regime. Anyway, it must be unsettling for them that their neighbourhood has been bombed by that Western coalition instead. But anyway, I am not going to focus on that. Beyond a certain point, it seems to me that any bombing offensive begins to run up in the crude and brutal calculus of war against the logic of diminishing returns, by which I mean that so much death and destruction has already been done that nothing politically or in strategic terms is achieved by doing more. Just to say. For the rest, the US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said yesterday in a meeting which was also attended by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, that the United States and Israel have come close to suppressing entirely Iran's air defences, and that before long they can start conducting air operations with manned aircraft over the territory of Iran itself, with presumably, well, in fact, with bombing by gravity bombs, by drop bombs dropped from aircraft. Now, I have to say, I found that a bit surprising myself, because I'd understood, especially from Israeli spokesmen, that this was already something that had been achieved some days ago. But Hegseth appeared to suggest that it had not yet been achieved at the time that he was speaking. Now, I would say that, in fact, I have seen pictures of what looked like American and Israeli aircraft flying over Iran in Iranian airspace. And there were reports earlier today that an American F-15 fighter jet had been shot down over Iran, which suggests that there is still some sort of air defense system still operating. Apparently, the loss of the F-15 is acknowledged, though exactly how it came down, so far as I'm aware, the US has not so far said. But anyway, but I've also seen the footage, I believe, from Israel of an Israeli F-35 shooting down a Yak 130 trainer. This is one of the two Yak 130 trainers recently supplied to Iran by Russia. And this F-35 seems to have shot down this aircraft, which, by the way, is subsonic and not really designed for air-to-air combat, just saying. But anyway, the fact that the F-35 was there presumably means that some aircraft, at least, are now risking Iranian airspace and are conducting some sort of operations above it. For the record, I doubt that the United States and Israel would be able to suppress Iranian air defense entirely. Iran is a huge country. It is twice the size of Ukraine. It has a population of 90 million people. It has many cities. It has a massive industrial base. It's very mountainous, with lots of places in the mountains where things can be hidden. It's also in places densely forested, and things can be hidden in those forests as well. I would have thought that the Iranians, who presumably have plans in advance for this kind of thing, will be careful to hide away and preserve at least some of their air defense equipment. And well, the longer this conflict continues and the more it appears that Iran is able to withstand the military pressure it is under, the more likely it is that the Iranians will be able to receive supplemental air defense systems from China and Russia. And of course, they can be brought out of hiding and deployed when the event, when the occasion arises and when the occasion calls. But having said that, total suppression is perhaps an ideal that is unachievable. It may be that the Israelis and the Americans are indeed close to achieving sufficient suppression to be able to conduct bombing raids with gravity bombs. But then again, we come up with the problem posed by the vastness of the country, because Iran is not only a huge country, it is also very diverse, very dispersed. There are many cities across Iran. There's only a limited number of aircraft in the American and Israeli air forces. They would not be able to cover the entire country all the time. It'd be impossible to do a thing of that kind. And any attempt to do it also is going to, over time, present more and more challenges. So some economic industrial activity is likely to continue, especially if assistance continues to be provided by China and Russia. And, well, an aerial campaign against Iran can do colossal damage, but provided the government system continues to function, even if at a reduced level, it cannot achieve the regime change objective by itself that some people in the West, that the United States in particular, seems to have set out as the objective. Now, there are other claims. There are claims that the US and Israel have been successful in destroying Iranian ground launchers, ground launchers for ballistic missiles and presumably drones. The extent to which this is true is again impossible to estimate. There is apparently photographic evidence produced by especially the Israelis of the destruction of ground launchers. I'm going to say straight away that I am incapable of making much sense of these photographs. And for the record, Simplicius the thinker, who is perhaps better positioned to assess the quality of these photographs, he finds the evidence dubious. The evidence that large numbers of launchers have been destroyed is dubious. Pete Hegseth and General Kane did make the further claim that Iran's launching of missiles and drones has sharply reduced by 80% in the case of missiles, by 70% in the case of drones. However, that is exactly what I remember was said early on in the 12-day war in June 2025. I think it is entirely understandable and in fact fully predictable that Iran, in the first hours after it was attacked, would expend, by its own account, thousands of missiles and drones in order to confirm to the United States and to Israel and indeed to the whole world, including Iran's population, that it was indeed still in the game, and that it would also take advantage of the first hours to do as much damage as it could on as wide a range of targets as possible, but that it would then start to reduce the launching rate of its drones and missiles and become more selective about its targets. And for all I know, that is all that is happening, that this is part of the strategy to wage a long war. So, yes, I can see the bombing continues. I can see that attacks on positions within Iran continue. But for the moment, Iran continues to conduct counter-strikes across the Middle East of its own. It continues to launch missiles and drones. It conducted more strikes against Israel last night, for example. Again, I'm not going to speculate on the effectiveness of these strikes. During the 12-day war, it became clear to me that the Israeli authorities are extremely sensitive about publishing information or allowing information to be published about the effect of strikes on Israel. And it took several weeks before the full extent of the damage done on Israel by Iranian missile strikes became clear, just saying. Iran was able to continue to conduct missile and drone strikes on Israel last night and across the Middle East, which shows that they're not out of missiles or drones entirely, or anything close, as far as I can see. And of course, and most importantly, the Straits of Hormuz remain closed. There is still no movement of ships through the Straits of Hormuz, except I believe that the Iranians allowed two tankers from friendly countries. I presume these were China, perhaps Russia, perhaps India, who knows? They allowed two tankers to pass through, but all of the remaining tankers remain bottled up in the Persian Gulf. I will return to the significance of that later in this programme. So that, it seems to me, is a broad overview of the military situation. Now, there are lots of other things taking place. There were lots of reports yesterday that the Kurds in Iraq, the Kurdish militias there, after apparently receiving peremptory demands over the course of rather agitated telephone calls between their leaders and President Trump. Anyway, that the Kurds have started some kind of ground operation against Iran. There were also reports that the United States, for its part, is providing some degree of air support to the Kurds. And there were also reports that the Iranians, for their part, were conducting strikes with missiles and drones against American and Israeli bases in Iraqi Kurdistan. And there was much speculation and a great deal of talk over the course across the internet yesterday about this ground offensive into Iran by the Kurdish militia. Now, there is very heavy fog of war about this. The Iraqi Kurdish militias themselves published a statement which appeared to deny claims that they were conducting any sort of offensive at all. They appeared to suggest that they were acting entirely defensively. The Iranian authorities then published a statement saying that the areas in western Iran that might be under attack from these Kurdish forces were under secure Iranian government control, and that the situation there was mostly peaceful and secure. Then earlier this morning, there was a further report from the Iranian authorities saying that there had been some kind of incursion, though something falling well short of a ground incursion, but that this had been successfully repelled by the Iranian security forces. So far, I've seen no film, no pictures provided by the Kurds of Kurdish forces operating in western Iran. And I would have thought that particularly at this time, considering the nature of this conflict, I would have thought that if a large-scale operation were indeed underway, we would by now have some video footage of it. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not going to happen, and the Kurdish militias are said to be large in number, and some of them are said to be very well trained, and they might indeed have the backing of the US military in some form. How far such an incursion might go, what its objectives would be, very difficult for me to say. My knowledge of the dynamics, the population dynamics in Iran, is patchy to say the least, but I have always heard that Iran's Kurds are very well integrated in Iranian society, that they speak a language close to Persian. Most of them are Sunni rather than Shia, but perhaps especially with the Kurds, who tend to have secular political movements, follow secular political ideologies, the importance of that might be overstated. And supposedly, there's never been the same sort of tensions between the Kurdish community in Iran as there have been historically with the Kurdish communities in other countries like Iraq, Syria and Turkey. Just saying. I remember that during the Kurdish insurgency in Iraq against Saddam Hussein's government in the 1970s, the Iraqi Kurds at that time actually received backing from Iran, to be precise, from the government of the former Shah of Iran, who was, of course, ruling Iran at that time. So it may be that if there is a Kurdish incursion into Iran, it might not receive a huge amount of support, or perhaps any support at all, from the local Kurdish population. Again, I cannot say this for certain. And besides, Iran does have substantial ground forces. They have history of being able to perform under air attack. Well, we'll see how it turns out. I'm going to guess that for the Iranian leadership, this issue of a potential Kurdish incursion is the greatest single concern that they have. In the meantime, the major event in this war is not the Kurdish invasion or the bombing of Tehran or the utterly gratuitous and horrible sinking of an unarmed Iranian frigate close to the coast of Sri Lanka, which was trying to return to Iran after participating in naval exercises in India, to which it had been invited by the government of India. I should say quickly and in parenthesis that this episode has caused a storm in India itself. I'm not saying a political crisis, but Prime Minister Modi of India has again come in for a great deal of criticism for the fact that he has not publicly rebuked the United States for this operation, despite the fact that this Iranian frigate found itself in a point of vulnerability precisely because it had been invited to participate in a military exercise in India. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss this or Prime Minister Modi's political difficulties, which are mounting, but which I suspect are containable. The point about that attack on the frigate is that it is irrelevant to the war. The United States has been talking at great length about its success in sinking all sorts of Iranian warships in the Gulf of Oman and, for all I know, in the Persian Gulf. None of that has any relevance to the ongoing war. Iran's navy was never a particularly potent force, just to say, and most of its warships, so far as I could see, are derivatives of frigates acquired by the late Shah of Iran, the former Shah of Iran, from Britain way back in the 1970s. So not particularly powerful warships by modern standards by any means. But this is not in any sense a naval war. So the fact that the United States is talking up at such length about the destruction of these warships may suggest that perhaps other more relevant targets up to this time have not presented themselves, and that the other parts of the military campaign are not going as well as expected. Anyway, before I leave this topic of the sinking of this Iranian frigate, there's been another point that has been discussed extensively, which is that the US Navy submarine that sank this frigate took no step to save survivors. It's been pointed out the German U-boats during the Second World War and the First and Second World War did just that. And that is considered an international humanitarian obligation. I believe that this is true. It is very much part and parcel of the rather ruthless way in which this whole war is being conducted of which the bombing of Tehran that I discussed in my program yesterday represents, of course, just one part. Anyway, my point is that these events are not massively relevant to the course of the war. The three things that matter are the bombing of Tehran, and much of the bombing does appear to be focused on Tehran. The possible actions of the Kurds in western Ukraine, and most pressingly and urgently, the closure of the Straits of Hormuz. Other things, the Iranian drone and missile strikes on Israel, the depletions of the American missile arsenals, all of these will have an effect as well. But the urgent things, as far as I can tell, the things that we should focus on at the moment are those three. Now, of these three, the most pressing is the closure of the Straits of Hormuz. And I discussed yesterday how a worldwide energy crisis appears to be brewing. And we see more and more signs of this every day. Energy costs in Europe continue to rise. There doesn't seem to be any plan, by the way, on the part of European governments on how to respond to that. I don't really see much evidence of the United States government thinking about what to do about it either. I read, however, yesterday in the Financial Times that the closure of the natural gas facilities, production facilities in Qatar is an escalating problem, that the longer that continues, the more difficult it will be to restart natural gas production. Of course, it can happen, but if the Straits of Hormuz were to reopen tomorrow, then apparently it would take Qatar about 2 weeks before it resumed natural gas production and liquefaction, by the way, to the same level as before. But if it takes a month or 2 months or longer, then the facilities, the production and liquefaction facilities in Qatar will begin to deteriorate, and the process will take much longer still, until eventually we reach a point where bringing facilities like that back into production will take a long time. And what applies to natural gas facilities applies apparently to oil fields and oil production facilities as well. Now, already Iraq has stopped all oil production. So the oil industry in Iraq has essentially frozen. And in fact, I believe it was yesterday, there was a total electricity blackout across the entirety of Iraq. There was no electric power for a long period of time across Iraq, with consequences I don't want to even speculate or think about. And of course, we're in the spring. If things like that were to happen in the summer, if there were to be no electricity in the middle of the extreme summer heat, so that air conditioning systems were not operating, well, at that point, I suspect life in the cities, in the Iraqi cities, would become unendurable. But that's Iraq. Iraq is a major oil producer and exporter, but it is not the most important. And according to a very interesting article I read in the Financial Times yesterday, we are reaching, or we are approaching, a tipping point in terms of production of oil in the Middle East as well. Now, for the moment, the Gulf producers are continuing to produce oil, even though, with the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, they can't export most of it. Most of the oil that they produce goes into the enormous gas storage systems that you tanks that you find scattered across the southern part of the Persian Gulf. However, once these storage tanks fill, there will be no alternative but to stop production. And what is true, apparently, of natural gas facilities, that the longer they remain turned off, the more complex resuming production becomes. Well, that is apparently doubly or trebly true of oil production as well. So, according to the Financial Times, Kuwait, one of the major oil producers, is roughly 3 days from the point when it's going to have to turn off production. One of the two other Arab oil producers, I can't remember whether it was the UAE or Qatar, is about 5 days from that point. Saudi Arabia is in a different position. It's far and away the biggest producer. It has far and away the largest oil storage facilities, and it is still able to export oil through pipelines that apparently go to the Red Sea. However, there must be worries about the safety of those pipelines, and it seems that the storage facilities in Saudi Arabia, though much greater than those of the other producers, are also mostly filled. I read that there are six big storage tanks. Four are filled. Two remain, still have space, but they're filling fast. There will come a point when Saudi Arabia also has to start reducing production and perhaps closing down production in some of these fields. Now, this brings me back to this extraordinary news conference or press meeting between Hegseth and Cain. And, well, there were all sorts of very striking things said, which were in some respects anomalous to the very optimistic picture that these two men were trying to give. I mentioned, for example, the fact that they spoke about air supremacy over Iran being about to be achieved so that aircraft could start to operate unimpeded across Iranian airspace and start dropping gravity bombs. I said that I'd assumed that this was already the case. So that appeared to be an admission that Iranian air defences, as of the time of that press conference at least, had not yet been fully destroyed. That was one thing. But I also noticed that the timetable for this war is being extended. So what we were being told, admittedly through anonymous informants before the conflict started, what we were being told would last a few days. The president then said might last 4 weeks. He said that publicly, which would take us up, by the way, to the time of his visit to China, where the president is due to visit China and to meet with Xi Jinping, just to say. And well, at this press conference, Hegseth seemed to speak of 8 weeks. And then this morning, I read about 100 days, a 100-day war that might last, in other words, until September, dangerously close to the midterms in the United States, by the way. Now, set that against these reports in the Financial Times about Kuwait and one of the other big producers having to go offline within 3 to 5 days. And earlier reports I'd read in other places that after a week of the Straits of Hormuz being closed, we would start to see the full crisis in global energy markets begin to gain force and to become visible in the most pressing ways. Now, the president himself, Donald Trump, is clearly unnerved about this. Yesterday, I discussed the fact that he spoke about the United States providing marine insurance to the various tankers that are holed up in the Persian Gulf and are unable to pass the Straits of Hormuz. It seems that the British insurers, Lloyd's and all of them, are now telling the ship owners that their insurance does not cover entering the kind of war zone that the Straits of Hormuz has become. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, said that the United States itself might provide, the US government might provide the ship owners with insurance. In other words, that the United States government, amongst being many other things, would become an insurer as well. Well, governments have been known to do these things, so perhaps we should not be cynical about them. I said that I thought that this would require agreement from Congress. Now, Congress yesterday, at least the Senate yesterday, voted on a resolution which was intended to permit, rather to block, further military action by the president against Iran without further authorization from Congress. Now, it was widely expected that in the Senate at least this resolution would fail, and it did fail. But it failed, I noticed, on a straight party vote. One Republican voted with the Democrats, one Republican, that was Rand Paul, voted with the Democrats to support the resolution. One Democrat, Senator Fetterman, voted with the Republicans to oppose this resolution. In the House, sentiment is much more divided. I think it might not be entirely straightforward to get a resolution through Congress, through the House of Representatives, whereby the United States extends insurance cover to tankers in this way. I think this might be problematic. I think if it is done, or if the United States were to attempt to do it without authorization from Congress, then it would be subject to potential legal challenges. I get the impression that the US Treasury Department is far from enthusiastic about this idea. So this may not happen very soon. As for the other option that the president spoke about, that the US Navy could escort the tankers through the Straits of Hormuz, I said in my program yesterday that that seemed to me a high-risk strategy because it would bring US Navy warships into a very concentrated area just off Iran's coastline. The Iranians would know exactly where the ships were. They still have drones. They still have missiles. Air defenses have been shown to be less than 100% reliable against drones or missiles. In a briefing to Congress yesterday, the same duo, Hegseth and Kane, apparently told Congress that they could not guarantee that every drone that Iran launches would be shot down, would be intercepted. Doing that is impossible. And, well, it would be a very, very high-risk operation. And I would have thought that the possibility of a US Navy warship being struck and seriously damaged, or conceivably even sunk, with a significant number of casualties, that would be very high, just to say. Anyway, I understand that shortly after the president suggested this proposal, the United States Navy said that this was not something that they would be prepared to do. So, for the moment, the Iranians retain their lock grip over the Straits of Hormuz. I have read that the only way to reopen the Straits of Hormuz would be to launch some kind of ground invasion of Iran precisely in this specific area in order to gain control of the northern shore of the Persian Gulf around the Straits of Hormuz, but that this would be an extremely complicated and very dangerous operation. The area is mountainous. There are lots of caves and other places where Iranian forces could be embedded and where they might hide. It might take days or weeks or months even to complete. There might be very heavy casualties in the process. It's not something that, for the moment, the US military is in a position to do. So for the moment, the Iranians continue to exercise a lock grip on the Straits of Hormuz. And the clock, at least according to the Financial Times, is ticking. Energy costs continue to rise in Europe and around the world. And if the Financial Times is correct, and in a week's time or 2 weeks' time, the entire Gulf area, including Saudi Arabia, goes off stream in terms of production, then the rise in world energy prices might become very significant and might start to do significant economic damage across the West as well, including, by the way, in the United States, which, in spite of being energy self-sufficient, is exposed to movements in the global energy markets, price movements in the global energy markets. So that's the major problem at the moment. Now, there are also reports of continued arguments between the Gulf states and the United States about supplies, or rather the lack of them, of air defense missiles. There's also reports now that there are shortages of air-to-air missiles. Now, the United States produces large numbers of air-to-air missiles for its fighter jets, but the supply, again, is not unlimited. And it was presumably created for a war, an air war between fighter jets. a war where American fighter jets were fighting Russian or Chinese fighter jets. Fighter jets are massively expensive. They are relatively few in quantity. You need only a finite number of expensive and complex air-to-air missiles in order to shoot down the even more complex and far more expensive manned fighter jets. But of course, the whole calculus of war has been changed, because what the United States is now pitted against are not just fighter jets, are not in fact fighter jets, or even subsonic cruise missiles, or even ballistic missiles, but huge swarms of drones. Now, drones can be produced in very, very big numbers in artisanal workshops. That is what Ukraine has been doing. It's been able to produce several hundred drones a day, thousands of drones a week, in artisanal workshops spread across Ukraine. Now, I have said in many programs that this is far less efficient than Russian drone production, which takes place in a uniform manner and in an industrial manner in big factories. And I don't take that back in any way whatsoever. But the point is that Iran has a much bigger population than Ukraine. It has far more engineers than Ukraine. It has probably factories scattered all over the place that could produce drones. And of course, if it needs to conduct artisanal production of drones, it probably, in fact, it unquestionably can, on an even bigger scale than Ukraine. And Ukraine apparently relies, at least to some extent, or has relied in the past, on Chinese technology to produce drones. It's imported Mavic drones from China. But of course, Ukraine's relationship with China has become very strained. Whereas Iran is a BRICS state, it's got very friendly relations with China. China has told Iran, Wang Yi told Araghchi, that China supports Iran in this war of aggression perpetrated against it. Is it not very likely that China will happily provide Iran with all the drone technology and facilities and spare parts that the Iranians need to produce their drones? Just say. So, whatever happens to Iran's missile arsenal, which may or may not be depleted, may or may not be destroyed, who knows? Whatever happens to that, Iran gives every impression to me as if it can continue to launch huge numbers of drones across the Middle East. I would have thought that the ability to continue to do that is essentially infinite. So, well, there it is. The Iranians could do all of this. They could attack American ships in the Straits of Hormuz. They could attack facilities right across the Middle East. They could, as I discussed in my program yesterday, attack the desalination plants. And they're not apparently limited to Saudi Arabia and to the Gulf. Some Israeli cities rely on desalination plants as well. I was not aware of this. But anyway, potentially all of that could be done as well. And I was reading today in Reuters that the other urgent problem the Gulf states are also starting to face is that they are risking food shortages. They depend on imports of food. Most of these come by ship. Those are not reaching them. There are problems financing these imports. there could soon be shortages of food in some of the cities. Again, I can't imagine that we're looking at starvation conditions or anything like that. At least I hope not. But we can again see the potential crisis there. So a 100-day war, or rather, which is what is now being talked about, that seems to me, if that is the real plan now, to amount to a crisis. I am not sure that the economies of the Gulf states, the economies of Japan and South Korea and Europe can withstand a war prolonged to that extent. Of course, there is and always will remain the big question, can Iran also continue for that long? Iran was supposed to be announcing the identity of the new supreme leader. We were told that an important meeting had already taken place and there'd been a shortlist and that the announcement of the supreme leader was about to come. But I've noticed that no such announcement has so far been made. It may be that the Iranians have actually already decided who the supreme leader is and that he has in fact been appointed. The speculation that it is Khamenei's son and that he is indeed the new supreme leader of Iran, and that given the threats from the United States and Israel to try to track down and kill the new supreme leader as soon as he appears, that the Iranians are deliberately, intentionally keeping the identity of this person secret. That, by the way, would not be inconsistent with Shia religious practice. There's all sorts of things that I've read about, which I don't know that I fully understand, and I'm not going to discuss here, about personages from Shia history, like the hidden imam and things of that kind. But I can imagine that within the Shia community, a hidden leader of that kind would not be either unusual or specifically offensive. But the alternative, which has to be more plausible, is that the Iranians are having difficulty convening the meeting to elect the supreme leader because of the bombing, or perhaps there are indeed dissensions within the leadership group as to who the new supreme leader should be, with rival candidates and an inability to agree on who that person should be. So there might be divisions, there might be all sorts of things of this kind going on. And of course, there is also the uncertain issue about what might happen in Western Iran with the Kurds. So it remains a war of attrition. It remains an endurance test between the United States and Iran. It remains a question of whose arsenal becomes critically depleted first. And it also remains the question of who buckles internally first. In Iran, where of course they're experiencing by far the greatest blows, but where they are engaged in an existential conflict, which the government and the political system may feel they have no alternative but to see through to the end. Or amongst us in the West, where it is not an existential conflict, it is a war of choice, a war, by the way, concerning which the opinions of most of us were never asked. On that last point, I would just add something further, which is that, of course, we're all passengers of this runaway train. We've already all of us experienced economic difficulties as part of the aftershocks of the conflict in Ukraine. The reason energy prices in Europe, and especially so in my own country, Britain, are so high. The reason Germany has been going through a process of deindustrialization is because of the war in Ukraine. But of course, this current conflict has that ability, potential ability, to take this much, much further, because, well, we can perhaps just about get through a cut-off of energy from one critically important source, which is Russia. But to be cut off for a long time from another critically important source, the Persian Gulf, on top of that, well, that makes an enormous crisis. Now, saying all of this, I wish I got the sense that European governments, the Japanese government, the South Korean government, were making some preparations for this. So far, I see none. There's been no attempt, for example, in Europe, so far as I'm aware, to try to restrict energy use through the summer, in order to make sure that whatever happens, there is some available gas and oil for heating through the winter. Nothing like that is being done, as far as I know, in any Western state. For the moment, everybody seems to be crossing their fingers and hoping that this operation is successful quickly, because perhaps it is too horrible to contemplate the alternative. Certainly, no one is seriously suggesting approaching Vladimir Putin and the Russians to see whether they would agree to start resupplying energy to Europe again, lifting sanctions, in other words. No one up to now is suggesting anything like that. Of course, if we start to have serious shortages by September, that might change. But for the moment, nobody's thinking or preparing for anything like that, just to say. So on this, by the way, of course, the Russians are making their own decisions. Now, yesterday and the day before, all sorts of reports appeared, which are subsequently confirmed, that a Russian commercial vessel, a modern Russian commercial vessel sailing the Russian flag, was attacked and apparently destroyed by drones, water drones, in the Mediterranean Sea, close to the coast of Malta, just to say. And I may as well say that I had information about this some time ago. I was told that these drone attacks on these Russian tankers are carried out by Ukraine using an old Foxtrot Soviet era submarine, which somebody, I'm not going to try to guess who, provided to Ukraine. And this particular submarine does not carry out its attacks using torpedoes, obviously, but uses the underwater drones instead. But I was also told by the source of this information, which, by the way, I should make clear, comes from Russia, that the submarine in question does get information, is assisted in its operations by some Western countries. Perhaps the United States, more probably Britain or France. The Russians are absolutely furious about this attack. They say that this crosses all the red lines. The Russian leadership has already spoken about providing its tankers with naval escorts. This particular tanker, by the way, did not have escorts. But then up to now, attacks have been focused on oil tankers rather than tankers carrying natural gas, LNG, which is what this particular tanker appears to have been ferrying. Anyway, the Russians are furious about this. And yesterday, Putin gave an impromptu interview with his favourite journalist, Pavel Zarubin, which has received extensive reporting in the Russian and global media. And Putin referenced this attack on the tanker. He also said that the Russians have information that the Ukrainians are preparing attacks on the Turk Stream and Blue Stream pipelines. The Russian intelligence agency, the SVR, has already talked about this, and I've discussed it in previous programs. And Putin said something else, that purely for economic reasons, unconnected to the attack on this particular tanker, but for economic reasons, given that the Europeans have already decided from 2027 to stop buying Russian LNG, well, it makes no sense for Russia to continue exporting LNG to Europe. Maybe the moment has come to stop that trade now, to do it immediately, and instead to develop the Asian markets, where Russian LNG, unlike in Europe, is welcome, as is Russian oil, and that there is no real cause or occasion for delay. And Putin is talking about that being done immediately. And of course, if you think that this is unconnected to the attack on the tanker in the Mediterranean, and if you also think that this is unconnected to the recent events in the Middle East and to the fact that Qatar is no longer able to export LNG, well, if you think that, then I have a bridge to sell you. So we could be seeing within the next few days or weeks, not just a cessation of natural gas exports, LNG exports from Qatar, but a stop of LNG exports to Europe from Russia as well. This at a time when the natural gas reserves in Europe are at a low level, an unusually low level, at a time when the Russians have been conducting attacks on natural gas facilities, storage facilities in Ukraine. And, well, I'm going to say it at a time when I think there's a possible question mark over LNG exports by the United States to Europe as well. The United States has been exporting a lot of LNG to Europe over the last few years. That LNG has come at a very high cost. One of the effects of this has been to reduce available supplies of gas in the American domestic market. And of course, the upward pull of higher LNG costs in Europe has had a further effect on pulling up natural gas prices in the United States. I said in the past that if there were issues with high energy costs in the United States, if there were possible gas shortages in the United States. I have no doubt whatsoever, given Donald Trump's priorities, that he would take steps to stop exports, LNG exports to Europe, and Europe basically be damned. I'm absolutely sure that he would be prepared to do that. People have pointed out to me the legal problems with this. They pointed out that this would mean going against contracts, that the LNG companies themselves might resist doing this. I've never seen anything like that stop Donald Trump from taking measures of this kind, and I don't believe it would stop him this time. So, if things continue along their present trajectory, we could be seeing a very, very difficult energy situation in Europe indeed. Now, I am going to make my own speculation here. I don't know how long Iran can endure this attack. It may be able to endure it indefinitely. It may be that it can only sustain it for a few weeks. But if it is able to sustain it for longer, then the depletion of military reserves and this crisis in the energy markets all but guarantees that we're going to have some attempt eventually to find an off-ramp by the United States, probably well before September, before that crisis really hits home. I cannot imagine that even an administration as eccentric as Donald Trump's would permit such a disastrous situation as the one I have just described arise. That is not where we are at the moment. I think the United States and Israel are still telling themselves that provided they keep up the pressure, Iran will crack. They probably still have some hopes of achieving something with the Kurds, just saying. But I think, in fact, that we are currently in an escalatory cycle, that rather than the United States pulling back at the moment, they're going to double and redouble what they're doing. But the point is going to come at some point over the next few weeks, provided Iran can keep going, when the United States is going to have to rethink its course and try to find a way out. The alternative is an economic crisis at exactly the moment when the midterms happen. Already, apparently, the opinion polls for the president and his party are very bad. Already the opinion polls show deep unpopularity for the war itself. One of the compelling reasons I would have thought for the president to want to change course is that if events continue to play out in the way that they're going and the Democrats win decisive victories in the House of Representatives and potentially in the Senate as well, then the president will face further impeachment. And perhaps this time, his position going into those impeachment proceedings will be more difficult than it has been up to now. I don't think that this president or any other president I can imagine would want to bring that kind of disaster down upon himself. But to repeat again, It all depends ultimately on Iran. It's on its own ability to keep the war going, and we'll see what Iran can do. Now, let's quickly turn again to the perennial topic of these programs. The Russians said yesterday that because of the situation in the Middle East, there is no real basis at the moment, no space or opportunity for further negotiations with Ukraine and the United States about the war. I've never myself felt that the Russians had any real sense of conviction about the negotiations at all. But it looks as if the negotiation track that has taken up so much of my time, and yours, by the way, those of you who listen to my programmes. Anyway, that negotiation track, for the moment at least, appears to be over. So it is all about the war now. And, well, the Russian pressure on the battlefields, on Orekhov, on Konstantinovka, on Slavyansk, on all of these places continues to grow. And we continue to see a countdown towards a major Russian offensive as soon as the spring thaw finishes, probably sometime in April. There are reports that without extra supplies of air-to-air missiles, there are already shortages in the US of air-to-air missiles. But without air-to-air missiles, Ukraine's F-16s are grounded because they use air-to-air missiles to try to shoot down Russian subsonic cruise missiles and drones. And of course, Ukraine is not receiving air defense missile interceptors either, because they're being diverted to the Gulf. I expect that the Russians are waiting for this process of depletion to continue still further. There have been many reports that the Russians are gathering missiles and aircraft for another big strike, and we could again start to see the Oreshnik system also being used. And this morning, a place called Yarovaya in northern Donetsk was also captured by the Russians. Again, these are relatively small places, but it's another one of those chess pieces or positions around the major remaining fortified lines that the Ukrainians have in Donbass, the cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. It's one of those other places essential for the long-term defence of this fortified line. And it's just fallen to the Russians in advance of the offensive. This operation in the Gulf, again, demonstrates the difference between the way in which the Russians and the Americans do war. The Americans try to do everything from the air, everything from the sky. They use enormous amounts of technological firepower right at the beginning. They are completely unabashed about massive devastation, about assassinations of political leaders. They show little concern for the civilian populations. We've seen the damage done to the school, the destruction of the school and the killing of the school children on the first day of the attack. We've seen other attacks as well. We've seen this brutal attack on this ship off the coast of Sri Lanka. But we also see that operations of this kind are time limited. And if they don't succeed quickly, they risk not succeeding at all. And we see the extreme aversion within the US military to large-scale losses and to the immense difficulties the United States has deploying ground troops. I was reading, before I did this program, an analysis by a Russian military official who's now turned commentator called Vladimir Trukhan. He said that it would take months or even years for the United States to create the logistical facilities in the Middle East to support a ground operation against Iran. And that would require deployment of forces greater than the United States actually has. By contrast, the Russians have no difficulty using ground forces. They have a much more holistic approach to war. They try to avoid attacks on the civilian population to the extent that they can. Some would say that they conduct war in a rather more conventional, old-fashioned way. But the key thing is they can sustain it. They can sustain it for the long term, and it seems that the United States cannot. We should wait and see what happens now in Ukraine in the spring. Well, that's my program for today. Be more from me soon. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, as well as Substack. Don't forget to check out our shop, links under this video. Also, please remember to support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and to check out our Substack site. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.